Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president was in Florida today following up on his State of the Union last night. We will talk about that speech a little bit. Bankers aren't getting much love in Davos. Our man Stephen Beard is there. And all that kerfluffle over Ben Bernanke not keeping his job, that was all phony baloney.
The ayes are 70. The nays are 30. The nomination is confirmed.
Well, there you have it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 28th of January today. This one is a Thursday, and it is good, as always, to have you here. Very quickly about the once and future chairman of the Fed before we really get going today. The procedural vote on Ben Bernanke's nomination that the Senate took this afternoon was not even close. He needed 60 ayes before he could get to a straight up or down vote. He got 77, so he gets another 4 years of interest rate meetings and congressional testimony. Last night in the Capitol, it was, of course, the State of the Union address. After talking about little else lately, President Obama didn't even mention health care reform until nearly half an hour into the speech. And when he did get to it, he started with a joke.
And by now, it should be fairly obvious that I didn't take on health care because it was good politics.
And also an apology.
I take my share of the blame for not explaining it more clearly to the American people.
From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner picks it up from there.
What President Obama has maybe failed to explain is what health care reform means for the average person and why the cost of doing nothing falls on all of us. Marcia Gold is a senior fellow at the Mathematica Institute.
You know, I've been studying health care for 35 years, and I have trouble following it.
But she says some things are clear.
The numbers keep going up and the costs keep going up, and it doesn't get any better.
The easiest explanation, the uninsured. According to the Congressional Budget Office, by the year 2019, there'll be 54 million people in the United States without health insurance. Doctors and hospitals pass on those costs in the form of premiums and higher hospital bills. J.B. Silvers is a professor at Case Western Reserve University.
That can be up to 10 or 20% of the bill that you're paying is to cross-subsidize those people that otherwise don't have insurance but are still getting care.
The cost of covering the uninsured also falls on taxpayers. Bob Atlas is a healthcare analyst in Washington. He says hospitals shift the cost of treating the uninsured to Medicare and Medicaid.
When there's more uninsured, that shows up as government costs.
In the end, Atlas says taxpayers foot the bill for almost half of all healthcare in this country. That adds to the deficit.
People's out-of-pocket premiums going up and the deficit growing are two parts of the same story.
And that's a story that Democrats hope to tell a lot better. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Boy, you have to feel at least a little bit sorry for Toyota. Last night, it expanded its enormous recall to include another million-plus vehicles in North America, not to mention a whole slew of them in Europe and China. The culprit, as you have probably heard by now, is the gas pedal, made not by Toyota, but by one of Toyota's many part suppliers. Truth is, most of what's in your car comes from someplace other than the car maker itself. And Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us that could turn out to be a big problem.
We call it a supply chain. But in the case of the auto industry, it's really more like a web. Car companies buy parts from thousands of suppliers, and most of those suppliers sell their parts to more than one car company. Jim Gillette is an analyst at CSM Worldwide. It's a consulting firm. He says suppliers do much more than just make the pieces that go into your car.
The automakers have depended more upon suppliers to do the full design, engineering, testing, etc., of the various components.
He says that's because R&D for complicated parts has gotten too expensive for car makers to do themselves. But it's expensive for the suppliers, too.
So you get a pedal maker, for example, that designs a pedal. They actually need to sell that pedal to several automakers.
That's why Ford said today it's stopping production on trucks in China. The pedals it uses there come from the same supplier that's being implicated in the Toyota mess. That supplier is based in the U.S. and makes the pedals in Canada. Craig Fitzgerald is an analyst at Plant & Moran, another consulting firm. He says carmakers also try to save money by negotiating bulk discounts from suppliers.
And Toyota is probably the best in the world at part commonization, sharing a single part among multiple vehicles that they produce.
He says the problem comes on the flip side.
When you have engineering issues and recalls, it produces astronomically large recalls.
Analysts say the Toyota recall will prompt a lot of soul searching across the industry as carmakers figure out how to be economical in ways that won't cost them more in the long run. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The needs that Haiti and its people are going to have as that country tries to rebuild are almost beyond imagining. Most immediately, it's doctors and humanitarian assistance, but some American colleges and universities are thinking a little bit longer term, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
Deborah Jensen teaches Haiti's Creole language at Duke University, and within days after the earthquake, she developed a crash course in cultural skills that will be needed by Duke students and professors in health, architecture, and engineering who are heading to Haiti.
To make them linguistically prepared and culturally sensitized, we want to help people to learn about very concrete details like how to get a cell phone and how to communicate with Haitian contacts.
32 people are enrolled, with more emails arriving each day. Professor Jensen thinks her course will be offered beyond this semester, given the long-term need to rebuild Haiti.
All of our students know, for example, about water quality. They know about sanitation. They know about first aid.
At Michigan Tech, Professor Bill Rose teaches future Peace Corps volunteers how to be first responders in natural disasters. He says those skills didn't used to be a high priority, but that's changed as more developing countries cope with floods, landslides, and active volcanoes. Meanwhile, 430 members of the American Association of State Universities and Colleges want to teach Haitians the society-building skills they'll need to break the cycle of poverty. Don Betts is the president of Northeastern State University in Oklahoma.
We are beginning to rally around the notion that a strong collaborative effort will make it possible for us to have a continuing impact on the fortunes of the people of Haiti as opposed to the very significant immediate relief and rescue impact.
Bett says state colleges and universities want to partner with Haitian schools to get rebuilding efforts underway as soon as possible. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Even Ben Bernanke getting to keep his job, news that broke just before the closing bell and couldn't salvage the day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are joined now in the studio by Marketplace senior editor Patty Hirsch, as we are from time to time. This time, though, with something a bit closer to your heart than usual, Patty. English football, the real football, and Manchester United, the New York Yankees, if you will, of the English Premier League. They are in something of a bind, yes?
Well, something of a bind. I mean, last night they managed to beat Manchester City, and they're now in the final of the Carling Cup, which is great news. But financially, not in such good shape. They're $1 billion in debt, at least. And the last couple of days, the Glazers, who own Manchester United, issued £500 million in bonds, and those bonds are not doing particularly well in the market today.
The Glazers, it's an American family, first of all. They own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They are not loved by Manchester United fans. But here's the question about the bond. People bought it. I mean, it was oversubscribed. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, I mean, the bond was very generously priced. I mean, one of the tranches was priced at 8.75%, which is very nice. But they had to issue that bond at a discount, had to sell it at a discount to get it done. And today, people in the market are backing away from this thing. They think it's way too risky. And it's been bid down to 94.5, so like way, way down off the 100 cents on the dollar that it sold for.
Back up for just a second. 8.75%, as you mentioned. I mean, that's unbelievably high.
Well, it needs to be. I mean, firstly, the club is deeply in debt. It's $1 billion in debt. Second of all, if it hadn't been for the sale of their superstar player Cristiano Ronaldo earlier this year for £80 million, they'd have made a loss last year as opposed to a profit.
What do we learn, though, about the larger bond market? I mean, debt is immensely important in financing an economic recovery. What does this bond deal tell you about that market?
Well, it's very interesting to look at the Manchester United deal as a kind of an example of what's happening in the wider market in Europe, because European investors have been jumping all over high yield bonds this year. Anything with, you know, a big price tag on it that they're going to make a lot of interest on, they've been all over that stuff. But now they're backing right back out of the market. And the reason for this is because they're looking at America and they're seeing over here that the chairman of the Fed is talking about maybe pulling back from the market, like reducing some of its stimulus programs, not helping out the market as much as it has in the past. And investors are worried that that's going to pull the rug out from underneath all of the growth that we've seen so far. And so anything that looks risky right now, they are steering very clear of.
Okay, steering clear, that's fine. But why is that bad news then for companies?
Well, because a lot of companies are regarded as being pretty risky right now because of the state of the economy. So if they tried to go into the market and borrow, maybe they wouldn't be able to get the money that they were able to get sort of, you know, 2 or 3 months ago. So it is actually going to inhibit growth, or has the potential to inhibit growth in Europe.
English football and the global economy. Patty Hirsch, our senior editor here at Marketplace. Thanks, Patty.
Always a pleasure.
There was a rare bit of judicial branch emotion on display during the State of the Union last night, as the president criticized the Supreme Court's recent ruling on corporations and campaign finance. Television cameras picked up Justice Samuel Alito shaking his head in disagreement. Alito sided with the majority on that 5-4 ruling. Commentator Justin Fox offers this dissent.
Economist Milton Friedman once wrote that an individual has lots of responsibilities. Responsibilities to family, to conscience, to charity, to church, to country. A business, he said, was different. Its one and only responsibility was, to quote, to engage in activities designed to increase its profits, so long as it stays within the rules of the game. Friedman's point was that CEOs should not go around imposing their notions of social responsibility on corporations owned by many shareholders. Since the only interest that could possibly unite all those shareholders was making a profit, that was what executives should focus on during their working hours. Think about this in the context of the Supreme Court's decision last week. In a landmark ruling, the court struck down longstanding restrictions on political spending by corporations. The ideal corporation, Friedman described, is out to do nothing but make as much money as it can within the rules of the game. It is supposed to behave in a supremely selfish and single-minded fashion. An individual who acted like that would be considered really unpleasant, maybe even psychopathic. The Supreme Court's decision frees corporations to play a potentially decisive role in shaping the rules of the game, rules that they have to obey. It's a little like putting inmates in control of the asylum. It's true, corporations are made up of individuals. That makes it hard to draw a line between what corporations do and what their individual employees do. It is even harder to draw a line between free speech and outright political activity. The Supreme Court majority cited this as the main justification for its decision. But equating corporate rights with individual rights, as the court did, just doesn't smell right. If corporations are individuals, they're individuals with some pretty serious mental and emotional problems. You'd think any self-respecting judge would want to declare them incompetent.
Justin Fox is the editorial director for the Harvard Business Review Group. We had him on the show last year talking about his book. It's called The Myth of the Rational Market. It's a pretty good read, too. You can talk to us online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Young, smart, and saving the world.
While all of my friends are going off to have nice Christmas holidays, I'm heading off to Serbia to do a workshop for refugees.
We will actually take you to Davos in a moment, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave up 115 points today. That is 1.1%, finished at 10,120.
The NASDAQ dropped 42 points, nearly 2%, closed at 2179. The S&P 500 down 12 points, 1.1%, ended the day at 1,084. Qualcomm dropped 14% today after the cell phone chipmaker lowered its sales outlook. Motorola dialed down 12% after it predicted lower sales, too. Hewlett-Packard and Yahoo each lost 3.3%. IBM processed a 2% decline. Google fell almost 1.5% today. Eastman Kodak sees a brighter economic picture ahead. Its better than expected earnings helped the inventor of the digital camera snap up a 24% gain. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. An eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the Advance Estimate Gross Domestic Product Report for the fourth quarter. Extreme sports enthusiasts check out ESPN for the Winter X Games continuing in Aspen. Tuned in to Oprah. It's her birthday. She'll be 56. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The World Economic Forum schmoozed its way into a second day of panels and programs today. Alongside the presidents, prime ministers, and CEOs who are in Davos, there is a subset of attendees called Young Global Leaders. They are young. They're all under 40. And they are all at the top of their chosen fields in everything from business to education to the arts. Marketplace's Sean Cole spent some time with one of them.
Hey there. Hi, I'm looking for Daniel Shapiro.
Dan Shapiro is the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. I met him 1 week before the Davos conference and about 4,000 miles away in his office in Cambridge, Mass.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
He's impossibly friendly and edge of his chair enthusiastic about his work. Everything Shapiro does comes back to the emotional side of negotiation and conflict resolution.
How do you negotiate the sacred?
When there are issues that each side claims are completely indivisible, I would rather die, says someone from each side. I would rather have my child die than say yes to your demand.
He's done workshops in China and Dubai and Egypt. He showed me a holiday card that the King and Queen of Jordan sent him. And it's depressing because...
I am 38 years old.
As am I.
Cool. When's your birthday?
November 19th. When's yours?
December 3rd.
Wow.
My God, you're now like my new brother.
I know.
Turns out we live down the street from each other. And we were both affiliated with UMass Amherst back in the 90s. That is, I was a classroom artist's model earning $8 an hour, and he was a grad student developing a conflict management curriculum for high schoolers in Eastern Europe.
And while all of my friends are going off to have nice Christmas holidays, I'm heading off to Serbia to do a workshop for refugees.
So you can see why the World Economic Forum took notice of him.
When did I first hear about the Young Global Leaders program?
Right. So in 2006, he got a phone call asking him to speak at a YGL forum in Vancouver. They hold their own events throughout the year, as well as at Davos.
That sounds interesting. You know, a group of young global leaders I'd love to speak to. And in my head, I'm thinking I'd love to speak to a group of high school students.
But he had a wedding to go to that same weekend. So he said, I'll call you back.
Get off the phone, look on the web, and see who these young global leaders are. Oh, so it's the founders of Google. It's some of the world's most influential business leaders. I called back very quickly and said, I figured out a way to rearrange my schedule.
And in 2008, he was officially designated as a YGL himself. It's not just a titular thing, either. The YGLs sometimes create funded organizations that get things done, like treating children who have intestinal worms or improving maternal health.
As a community, we have the business resource, we have the academic resource, we have the intellectual and NGO resource. How can we combine our efforts toward great value? And it's that same seed idea that is what keeps me going back to the World Economic Forum.
And this is his fourth year in a row. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
On the line with us now from Davos is Dan Shapiro. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Kai?
I'm all right. Listen, it seems like Davos is something that's right up your alley. I mean, you're a guy who does international negotiation and conflict resolution. Are you in your sweet spot?
I am definitely in my sweet spot. This is sort of a tornado of sweet spots. There's so many international leaders here, business leaders. Literally, every person you bump into is someone who you want to talk to about something, to hear their perspective, to offer a suggestion on how they might do things differently. It's a pretty incredible experience.
Do you get a chance to do a lot of work with CEOs and have them do some conflict resolution?
I think this is where a lot of the most important work actually gets done. It's the opportunity to sit down over dinner and sit next to a CEO of one of these major companies, to a global leader, and say, look, what's your perspective on this? How have you been dealing with the situation? What's going on behind the scenes that you can't quite talk with people about in front of the media? And let's think about this together using negotiation frameworks.
And how often does that work out well for you, though? I mean, how often do they say, gee, Dan, that's a great point?
I am constantly surprised at the level of receptivity to these ideas. It's quite anxiety-provoking, knowing that you are talking with people who have such great influence on many of the structures of our world, and yet they are very open. There's something about the Davos air that sort of washes away the status, and everybody, to some extent, is seen as an equal.
Well, on that topic, though, I mean, the theme of this year's conference is rethink, redesign, and rebuilding the global economy. If you could pick one thing that you wanted people at Davos to understand about that, given your background, what would it be?
Don't forget the human being. I think it's too easy to have, especially when you have all of these world leaders, key decision makers from organizations, you can start seeing the world as just a top-level world, forgetting that there is a huge grassroots community. Your constituents are your most important voice. Don't forget to listen to that voice.
What's the worst part about Davos?
Well, the cold is not very nice here. No, honestly, the worst part for me is the lack of sleep. There is just constant buzz here from 7 a.m. until 4 o'clock in the morning. There's just so much activity. You bump into Warren Buffett one minute. The next minute, I'm standing in line with the head of state from Latvia, then talking with an international artist. It's just mind-blowing, the diversity of perspectives that are here, as well as the accomplishment of those who have these perspectives.
But you can deal with the lack of sleep, right? Because you're young and you can handle it?
I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old at home, but even with that practice, I'm still not very good at it.
Dan Shapiro, he's a young global leader at the Davos Forum this year. He is also the founder and director of the Harvard International Negotiation Program. We talked to him in Davos. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Unless you've got a private jet to take you there, Davos isn't the easiest place in the world to get to. It's a 2.5-hour train ride from Zurich, just a little bit shorter by car, and maybe that sense of isolation is why the World Economic Forum is there in the first place. But once you get into town, the atmosphere inside the Congress Center itself can be a little insulating, because for all the congeniality that Dan Shapiro was just talking about, there is a group of people at the conference this year that isn't all that popular. But they are trying. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is in Davos for us this week.
The Davos Yodeling Club, a good place perhaps to seek out some real Swiss opinions. While hundreds of foreign VIPs debate the issue in the center of their town, who do the locals blame for the economic crisis?
The banks, the managers of the bank, they have to learn really a little bit and from this crisis, and they should reduce the bonus. That's the big item here. That's also my opinion to these people.
And on the TV news, more anti-banker sentiment from the Swiss president speaking at the World Economic Forum.
Bankers are already trying to wriggle out of their responsibilities.
Drinkers in this small bar nodded vigorously as they watched. Bar owner Tina Schmidt says the Swiss are no different from anyone else. They don't like bankers.
No, this is very, very, very bad. Nobody's happy with the banks.
And that in a country where banks in the past were a major source of national pride. It shows how much of a mountain the bankers have to climb. Meanwhile, back at the Forum in the centre of Davos, the bankers are struggling to win back some public and political support. Many stayed away from last year's meeting. This year, they're back, lobbying the many governments represented here, arguing the case against a regulatory crackdown. Here's the head of Barclays, Bob Diamond, in the Forum's opening session. He criticised President Obama's plans to cut the big banks down to size.
I've seen no evidence, I've seen no academic study, I've seen no analysis that suggests that shrinking banks and making all banks smaller or more narrow is the answer.
He says Mr. Obama's plan to tax and curb the banks will cut off credit and prove totally counterproductive.
The impact of that on jobs, the impact of that on the economy, particularly global trade and the global economy, would be very negative.
And it would drive business away from Wall Street. That's the view of Lord Levine, head of the British insurance giant Lloyd's of London. He says that in the past, tough US regulations, like the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, proved a boon for Britain's finance industry.
In the City of London, we wanted to build a statue to Messrs. Sarbanes and Oxley for delivering so much business to us.
But the bankers have not been entirely among friends at the Forum. Norway's top businessman, who makes fertilizer, unleashed a mini torrent of abuse. Harvard professor Neil Ferguson was also critical, saying that some banks were too big for anyone's good.
Too big to fail institutions now dominate financial markets on both sides of the Atlantic. And if we leave that situation intact, I'm afraid we're planting the seeds of the next big crisis.
Billionaire financier George Soros also weighed in here against the big Wall Street banks. He said they were tone deaf to the public outrage. Outside the conference centre, that outrage seems to be swelling. It may be some time before the Swiss learn again to love their bankers. In Davos, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
When was the last time you heard a fifth of Beethoven, by the way? Anyway, a final note today for the pronunciation purists among you. We have gotten a couple of emails telling us that I am saying Davos wrong, that the Swiss, they say it more like this.
Davos.
And that's great, but here's my thought. Imagine if Stephen Beard were in, say, the French capital instead of Davos. Should I say, here's Stephen Beard in Paris? Maybe it's just me. I don't know. Let me know what you think. Letters@marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow, it gave up 115 points, 1.3%. The NASDAQ down 42 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 dipped 12 points, 1.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, our coverage from Davos continues with billionaire investor George Soros. And on this broadcast, PepsiCo's CEO Indra Nooyi shares her thoughts, also from Davos, on how we got into the mess we're in.
I think the financial crisis came about because there was a maniacal focus on the shareholder.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.